Session number 23848-09.
Mr. Wildgust, Reel 9. Right, Mr. Wildgust, you were talking about late 1942 and coastal defence duties on the east coast of England, and you mentioned that there's quite a lot of opportunity for socialising and so on. Now, you were an officer now. You've mentioned earlier it was 10 shillings per day. Did you feel that kind of that you had the money to do what you wanted to do in terms of necessarily the time to do it?
Well, my salary had risen to the amazing amount of 10 shillings a day, so I got £3.10 a week. And so I was comparatively well off. I mean, it was after seven shillings, 14 shillings a week, and 7 shillings to your next of kin. After 7 shillings, £3.10 was quite a lot of money. And I suppose, bearing in mind that beer was about 9 pence a pint at the most. But no, I had no problems in that respect. And mess bills, people had said, oh, you must worry about mess bills, but mess bills have never got to any great height because we didn't really have a proper mess. Everybody was living individually in hotels and boarding houses. And we didn't have the opportunity to congregate as an officer's mess at all. So the only time we did sort of mingle socially was in the local hotels and pubs. Sorry about that, Mitchell. But I always remember there was one Major Saunders. Now, Major Saunders was a regular Foresters officer, and he'd been stationed in Jamaica when the war broke out. And the 1st Battalion was sent from Jamaica and the West Indies generally to the Middle East, to Libya, where they were lost in, I forgot which action it was, but one of them. And he managed, I don't know whether he happened to be in Cairo at the time, but anyway, he managed to be one of the few surviving officers and came back to England. And he joined our battalion at the same time as I did. In fact, I met him on the train going there. And so he'd been out of England from 1939 until 1942. And when we went to one of the dancers, the ATS, the WAFs were holding in one of the pubs, as a dance hall, he was amazed. He said to me, do women actually come over and ask you to dance? He said, I've never heard anything like it. I mean, he was at the old school where no woman was brave enough to even consider asking a man to dance. And he thought it was very much against the rules. We had another officer who now I won't mention because he brought along a girl to one of the dancers who everybody knew as Haystack Annie and was well known for all ranks of the place. But he hadn't known about her past activities in Yarmouth. And he sort of brought her and introduced her to the colonel once. I don't think he ever did it again. But that was quite amusing. Everybody was interested in that. And generally we had quite a good time there because it was exciting. I mean, you had the excitement of sort of war. And unfortunately, though, shortly after I left, about a week after I left, I had a hit-and-run raider that dropped a bomb smack on the doorway of the ATS billets, and they'd been doing drill on the front, and when the air raid warning went, they all rushed back into the building for cover, and the bomb hit them as they were all going through the door. There were about 40 were killed, I believe. But that didn't get very much publicity at the time, and I have spoken to people who were there at the time, and they said it was a bit of a shambles. So although hit and run were annoying, they did at times cause quite heavy casualties. But the only other thing that was sort of gave you an idea of what we had to put up with. We had a soldier, because all the mines were, the beaches were mined, and as we'd lost the plans of the, or at least never had the plans of the Royal Engineers of where they'd planted the mines, some had been washed up and some were sticking out of the sand and some were completely buried in the sand. And so all these minefields were marked off with barbed wire with notices to that effect. And a fellow called Private Thorpe came to me one morning. He'd been to see the MO and he had an impetigo and he'd got some ointment all over his face. And he said, "What am I to do now?" So I said, "Well, go down to the beach," and there's Lieutenant Millard there, he was doing some wiring, "and you report to him and he'll give you something to do." The next thing, of course, I knew, somebody came running up and said Private Thorpe had been killed. And he had finished doing the wiring job around the minefield, and the corporal was the other side. And he told them, right, he said, "Come over here and join me." And instead of going round the wire, this chap got over it and went straight across the minefield with another fella. When the corporal saw what was happening, he told him to stay where he was and to retrace his steps the way he had come. And I don't know whether he turned round to start, but anyway, he hadn't gone half a pace and a mine exploded, and we couldn't find anything. They couldn't find anything of him at all. The other chap, he got away. He ran like hell and got out. But we did find. Eventually, we found. They found his tin hat and a boot. And then later on, my sergeant came up and he said, "We found his head, sir. Would you like to see it?" And I said, "No, thank you very much." He said he looked a bit pale, which at the time we thought was rather amusing, but it wasn't. But he looked pale because, of course, this ointment he got on his face. And the other chap, a fellow called Private Creedy, he finished up in a mental home, and he never came back into the army again, although nobody at the time was sort of worried about what happened to him. But that was sort of typical of the silly things that did happen during the war.
Was that your first encounter with kind of death?
That was, well, apart from we'd had an accident or two at Sandhurst, but that was the first time it had happened to a serving soldier accidentally.
Now, but, at this point, I think it would be interesting if you could, first of all, you came to the 16th Show of Foresters. If you could just describe the structure of an infantry platoon, mm-hmm. and how you were obviously put in charge of this platoon. How many men was it?
An infantry platoon with three sections of 10 men. Each section should, in theory, have a full corporal and a lance corporal. And then the platoon itself has a lance sergeant and a full sergeant and a subaltern. That's how it goes, and in each section has a Bren gunner and a Tommy gunner and somebody within the platoon to carry a 2-inch mortar. And that was the structure of an infantry platoon. And of course there were three platoons to a company, and generally about four companies to a battalion. So you've got about 100 men in the company, 120 men in the company, and although they were the rifle companies in a battalion, of course you've got the anti-tank section, you've got the MT section, you've got the machine gun section. So in the end the battalion sort of works out at about 800 to 1,000, which I'm sure you knew a little bit. But my platoon, I suppose, as I say, I've got a record of it somewhere, they range from 18 to about 22. One of the sergeants, Hefford, he was a good sergeant as a trainee, but when it came to the thought of going abroad. A lot of these sergeants suddenly decided they weren't as patriotic as they thought they were. And that my particular sergeant decided to go home on leave and commit bigamy, which of course in those days was a punishable offence. So he got, I think he got put in prison, I'm not quite sure, but at least he got out of going on a draft.
And he did that deliberately? He did that deliberately?
Yeah, yeah. And in Africa, there was, in the foresters actually, because there was one particular sergeant who went absent without leave at a critical point, and he was, of course, demoted and put in prison. But it saved him going to Salerno in Italy. And another sergeant who, again, I won't mention, I met after the war, and he admitted he'd been a fool, but he also, and he'd had a very successful army career, actually. Even in action, he'd been recommended, but in the end, he decided it was all too much and wandered off somewhere. So people's attitudes changed a lot when they got to the thought that they might be posted. Our main job at Yarmouth was, again, coastal defence. And we were taken by, I don't know who it was now, but it was some superior officer who took me with my platoon to show me my positions in case of invasion. And the invasion, as I say, was quite on in those days. We used to get red and purple warnings, and on the purple warning and the red warning, you had to get your men back wherever they were. And on more than one occasion, I had to go to the local cinema and get them to put a slide over the film to say men of this company to report back to the barracks, which didn't please them, or report back to unit. Anyway, we were taken to this boathouse, which was on the coast at Yarmouth, and it consisted of an old white factory-type building, and inside there was a First World War American Browning machine gun, painted white, with 300 rounds of ammunition. And they said, that is your weapon that you will defend the coast. I said, if you look down to the right there, you'll see a gun sticking out. He said, that's where the Navy take over. It was about 300 yards. And he said, and that way, you're in charge of the beach from there to the pier, where the Home Guard are. And he said, of course, you've got your infantry, your ordinary weapons. Now, he said, if this building becomes untenable, you will then retreat 50 yards to the rear to slit trenches. So we were duly shown these slit trenches. And then he said, if these become untenable, you will then retreat another 50 yards back to the fish market. Well, the fish market was a red-bricked square building which looked a bit like a Beaujolais fort. It had a parapet running around, which was almost like a walkway for a castle. And so, in the course of this tremendous attack by the Germans, we had three separate positions, all of which were all in within 100 yards. And quite rightly, we assumed that if there was an invasion, the first 100 yards would be pounded straight away. But he was very optimistic and said, now, when you're in your last position at the fish market, by that time, reinforcements will have come from Norwich, so you'll be all right. And that was how we were supposed to defend Britain. And the more I tell you, the more daft it seems. But at the time, we took it quite seriously and felt that it was within our power to repel the invaders at this time.
And so did this fall in with the kind of the paper tactics that you had, Alexander?
Yes,
so it was a continuation of that. Could you just take us through a typical day with you're in charge of the platoon at Lowestoft? I mean, how would you organize? You know, you're in charge of this platoon. What would you? When would the day start? What would happen? How would you? What would you be looking for? Inspections and so on. What's
Well, they'd get up about, I've forgotten what time we used to get up now, about 6 o'clock, I suppose. We had breakfast about 7. And you'd be on parade at, I'll say, 8. And there was a general inspection and a roll call. Then, invariably, you'd sort of fill it with the drill and weapon training or revision. Then we'd have fieldcraft. We'd sometimes do, particularly being at the coast, I used to take them out and they used to fire live ammunition out to sea. And if they were on a scheme or a patrol, that type of thing, I'd use live ammunition. In fact, I nearly killed a bloke once. He said that bullet came a bit near to me. He was up a tree at the time, and I'd fired at about half a mile distance. I just fired in the air, but of course the trajectory of the bullet brought it down. And I'm very pleased I didn't hit him, because I should have had some answering to do. But and then they break off for lunch, and then we did a lot of, on that particular part, we did a lot of defences, digging more slit trenches and more defences and putting up more barbed wire. Occasionally, again, we had some Lee Enfields which had been adapted for firing 2-2 rounds. And I used to take those out and let them do sort of firing in unorthodox places like lanes and in woods. And at one time I found some wire lying across the wood and we strung it up between two trees and put some cans on it. And the idea really was to let people take snapshots at these things. I think the first shot severed this wire, which we decided was a very good shot. But what we didn't know was it was a landline from battalion headquarters. And it was Wally Binch who came up on his motorcycle one day and he said, you're wanted at battalion headquarters, sir. So I said, well, I haven't had a message. He said, didn't you get one on the telephone? I said, no. No one's had anything. And I said, OK, well, I'll come. And we never admitted that we'd been responsible for severing our communications between the battalion headquarters and ourselves. I know what happened if anything really important had happened, but we got away with that. But that was about it, really. There wasn't very much else to do, and I think by 4:30 to 5, we'd finished, and then we let the... we had to obviously make guard rotors. Unfortunately, my two superior officers, one had his wife billeted locally, and the other one just couldn't care less about me because he was superior to me. And I was invariably left in charge of the battalion at night, of the company at night, rather, and very rarely ever got out. Until one of the drivers, who seemed to get on with me very well, said, why don't you commandeer a truck, sir? And I didn't realise that I was in the position to do these sort of things, you see. I'd always either had a taxi or got on the bus. And he said, well, I'm a driver, you're an officer, there's a truck, why don't you commandeer it? And I never did particularly, but it was a thing that I never thought of. I didn't realise what power I had, you see. That was the daft thing about it.
Now, you mentioned that there would be various schemes that you would go on. Mm-hmm. At what level were these schemes? Were there any big schemes, kind of divisional schemes?
Yes, well, no, we had the battalion schemes. The one that I do remember was a complete waste of time, and nobody knew what they were doing. And
could you describe that?
Well, I can't really describe it. All I remember was this Sergeant Rice, who was had been one of my superior sergeants in the ranks, who I got on very well with, and he couldn't understand what was going on. I've got on. Now you come to mention it, I think the battalion was mixed up with a brigade scheme. But the orders had been so scant that nobody really knew what they were doing. I have vague recollections of there being umpires that said, "This, you know, you're dead," or "This company's wiped out." But it got to be such a shambles that we were all very pleased to sort of creep away and make excuses to disappear for various reasons, and nobody was ever reprimanded or asked why it had failed in such an abysmal way, but it had.
And that was that a common feeling about these schemes, that they were a bit of, bit of a joke, or were they taken seriously?
Well, they were taken seriously until you realised that nothing was going to come of them. I mean, the same sort of thing happened at Sandhurst. I mean, there were schemes there, but they never sort of amounted to anything. There was no... no sort of result of all your efforts. Nobody could say whether it was successful or what, or you didn't do this, or you... There were never post-mortems afterwards as to what went wrong.
Now, looking at your platoon at this period in the 16th Battalion, what kind of soldiers were these men? Where did they come from? Were there any kind of personalities that stood out? You've mentioned that some of them were a little bit bolshy. You've used that phrase.
Well, generally speaking, soldiers were bolshy when they didn't get the job that they thought they were going to get, or they thought that they were capable of doing. The most common were men who wanted to be in the MT section, drivers and that sort of thing. I found this later on in my service, they assumed, because they were a driver or worked in a garage, or that when they got in the army, they would immediately be given the job as a driver. Now, the educational standards in the army weren't all that high. We proved many years later that 11% of all the intakes were semi-illiterate or illiterate. And a lot of these drivers couldn't even, when you approached them, said, "Can you read a map?" And they hadn't a clue even of reading, never mind reading a map. And I said, "Well, you know, if you're a driver, you've got to fill in worksheets, and you've got to be able to follow directions on the roads and a map reader, that sort of thing." And they looked at you, gone out. That's the thing they never thought about. So when he got a man brought into the army and suddenly found he was a rifleman, full stop, when he'd hoped to have something a bit more glamorous, they were a bit bolshy, you see. You probably needed cooks. So he said anybody cook, and if somebody put their hand up, he was a cook, and that was the end of it. And he probably resented being a cook. A lot of them didn't, of course, because they were able to get more rations than anybody else. But and also it probably meant that they wouldn't be posted. But a lot of them were, of course, at this time, were beginning to be drafted in. They weren't volunteers any longer. A lot of them were what can we call them?
Conscripted.
Conscripted, that's right. Lots of them were conscripted.
Were they mainly from the Nottingham and Derbyshire area still? Or did you have men from elsewhere?
Yes. What I will do, if I may, later on, I'll see if I can find my roll book, because then it gives you not only their ranks and their trades, but also their ages and where they came from. And
what were the kind of common kind of minor discipline problems that you might have, or minor problems with inspection? What were the kind of things you would, on a normal?
I'm sure without leave, only for 24 hours.
What would be the punishment for that?
Well, it depended. It depended on how lenient or you needed to be. I mean, some of them, your case is missed. I mean, I was looking at my own diary that I was late and the case was dismissed. Depended on the attitude of the officer. Some of them were done at company level, and if they weren't, they were remanded for the commanding officer, who had his special days of dealing with miscreants.
And what day was that?
Well, I don't know.
Well, that was a special day in the week.
Yeah, it was a special day put aside. I think it was generally that. I mean, you'd get the odd one. It depended there on the NCO. I mean, if anybody sort of back chat or dumb insolence, you could get them for that. I mean, dumb insolence was a good way of getting people on a charge. But they'd probably be given an extra parade or an extra guard duty or something like that. The bad lads might get 7 days or 14 days confined to barracks. And then after that, of course, it was left to what they term court-martials. They weren't really all that bad. But they used to get travelling court-martials that came around and set up stall in the local town, and everybody sent the bad cases to them, and they were tried by a man who was appointed to the job, who led the proceedings, and usually flanked by two junior officers who were still influenced by what he said, but were there purely for democracy's sake. I had to do that on one or two occasions, and I was asked, nobody really knew what they were doing, because we hadn't been taught about law at all in the army.
And what were the cases? Can you remember what the cases involved?
Yeah. Well, I had a case when I was asked to defend a man who'd had gone absent off a draft. He was due to go overseas. And his defence was that he thought he'd get killed, which was a fairly good defence. And we went along to this court-martial, and nobody knew what they were doing at all. I hadn't a clue what I was supposed to do. I didn't know whether you had to sort of do it like an American court scene.
So your only knowledge was of Hollywood films.
Mm. And as defence, the prosecution had any idea, and luckily when they sat down, the sort of presiding officer said, "I think we'll adjourn, this, because nobody really knows what they're doing." And he didn't, so that was that.
Did you actually present the case that the man was...
I tried to, yes, but it was sort of... I honestly don't know how he got out of that one. But I do remember going on later again on court-martials, and there was one where the charge was read and the man was convicted, and the presiding officer said 6 weeks or six months. And this man, before he left, smirked. So he added hard labour, you know, and said, "That's how we deal with these people." And whether that chap smirked when he went down, I don't know, because in those days you had these hard labours. And then you had occasional inquests. I had an inquest where a man had murdered his girlfriend and committed suicide, and he'd shot himself with a rifle. It was all jolly good stuff, you know.
And these were all men within the 16th Battalion?
Yeah. And later, yes. Yeah. Well, no, these were later on, actually, but they were all from the foresters and that sort of thing.
Now, looking at your platoon at this period, how did they strike... I mean, you hadn't been in action yet, but how did they strike you as soldiers in terms of their marksmanship, their ability to march, their, you know, general soldierly bearing?
It was okay. I mean, their marksmanship was good. They're all fairly good riflemen. It was just that you didn't know how you were going to react in actual action yourself. But you assumed that they would do what they were told and would do it properly. I mean, they've been trained enough.